mic should be good to go. So you're unmuted. Test it.
Hello.
Perfect.
Thanks so much, Brendan and Tanisha and everyone for having me, Karma, and thank you for the mics everything. I feel like I'm on Charlie Rose a little bit. So thank you all for being here. This exhibition, Marigolds, I think one of the things that I'd like to start off with before we kind of get into the discussion of the works themselves and kind of the thinking behind them is the namesake. So the stories, the title Marigolds comes from a 1969 short story by Dr. Eugenia Collier. And I guess, has anyone heard of it or read it before? One of the things that was really interesting to me when I first learned about the story is that I'd actually read it before. I didn't realize until like much later. It's like very heavily anthologized in like children's or like 10th grade textbooks and stuff like that. So I knew it like felt familiar, but I'll go through the story. It's set during the years of the Great Depression in rural Maryland, and it's narrated by a 14-year-old girl named Elizabeth. And what's happening in the story is that it takes place over the course of like a summer, and she marks that summer as the end of innocence and the beginning of compassion. She and her friends just have to occupy themselves during these, you know, really long days. Their entire community is living in poverty. It's completely abject. And one of the characters in the town is Miss Lottie, and she's this outsider figure. She is tending to this patch of marigolds, which really stand out in this like kind of depressed landscape. And Elizabeth says that they're too beautiful. They didn't make sense in that landscape. One night, Elizabeth overhears her father, sort of the head of the household, just breaking down and crying. And that just sends her into kind of a real bit of confusion. She says that her world turns upside down. And she climbs out of her window in the middle of the night and goes to Miss Lottie's house and tears up the flowers. And in that process, she's caught. And it's in that moment where that's the moment where she realizes, you know, this is what it means to have compassion. This is what it means to really think about life from another person's perspective. Those marigolds were, for Miss Lottie, the only kind of semblance of hope or the only kind of form of escape from, you know, this life of abject, brutal poverty. It's funny, you know, if you Google Eugenia Collier marigolds, one of the first things that comes up is, like, what do the marigolds symbolize? I guess a lot of kids have that on the test. But I think one of the reasons why this story is so central to this exhibition and was so central to Alex's thinking is because of this way of really realizing, you know, what does it mean to see life from somebody else's perspective? What does it mean to look for potential in a world that doesn't want to offer you any? What does it mean to look for means of relating to the world differently? So I think, Alex, one of the things that I'd like to maybe start with is how that sort of thinking unfolds through the show. Maybe we could start off with, like, you know, the works actually start outside with the Bambi sign and with the photograph, and then maybe we could just kind of, like, walk through virtually.
Okay, great. So thank you for that. Like Tusef said, when I was initially thinking of a show for this space, I have long admired flowers, and I have long admired misunderstood subjects, and something about this particular short story where marigolds, which are a really beautiful flower, incite rage in this young girl. And I thought that was a kind of reverse collision of emotions that maybe is typical of my work. If I think about Eminem or Michael Myers or The Wicked Witch, these are all villains that I have come to empathize with and try to understand. And so I thought it was a nice point of departure to flip that script and think about something that's typically considered beautiful and how it can be haunting. And so starting with the outside image, it's an image of my nephew who is sleeping. And I thought it is hard to imagine what that person might be thinking or what any person might be thinking if they are anyone else but yourself. And to shut your eyes and go to a place that is unseen is quite appealing to me and is probably relatable in a time when the world seems very tumultuous as it is now. And I'd like to say that for this show, I was thinking about the structure that is this camera technique that was invented by a German animator named Lottie Reiniger. And Lottie Reiniger in the 20s made the multiplane camera as a way to create deep space in cartoons by painting and collaging images on multiple layers of glass and shooting a camera through this space. It was a way to sort of break through the screen or to access the inaccessible. And if I start thinking about the frustration of the character in Marigold's Lisbeth and thinking about access and thinking about powerless people and how one manifests power at a time when one's powerless, or how someone manifests a way to break through a screen or bridge a gap, I began thinking about this child and how to navigate a place, this child's place of dreaming, in a real physical space. And so when I make shows that don't have kinetic sculptures or moving image, I still think of them as short films. And so if the trailer is the image outside of this space, then midway through this film or this experience of the show is in the back. And the sort of ending or the climax is maybe on your way out the door. And what I've introduced is a bunch of symbols that sort of walk you through a story about some of the things that maybe you experience in a day, violence or grief or joy or seduction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of background, I think, just for everyone's sort of information, Alex studied, animation in school, and so much of what that technique is, those formal elements of animation have informed this work and a lot of your other work, and I think that the multiplane camera established a new way for people to view images, right? Like, it changed the way that people could kind of experience viewing. And that sort of perspectival shift is something that happens sort of conceptually throughout the show. So going sort of, backtracking a little bit into where the relationship between animation and this perspectival shift is these works that you see on the wall, they're neoprene works, they all actually derive from cartoons, from comics that are actually in the gallery down the street. You can see them, and you've taken elements from each of those cartoons, whited them out, sort of taken them out of that context, and then placed them, blown them up to like different proportions. So each of these sculptures, these neoprene works, have had a life kind of before this, in that context of the cartoon. And I think that relationship is super important as we look at this, because so much of, I think, what is unique about these works is that they're they're so graphic from a distance, you know, that you can tell that they've had this kind of origin story in the cartoon. But as you kind of move closer, you recognize their death, you recognize how kind of weighty they are and substantive, and that kind of recognition is, I think, sort of conceptually so linked to what happens in the story. So Miss Lottie, she's this outsider figure. She lives on the edge of town. She's the children call her a witch. You know, like she's this completely dejected kind of figure. And it isn't until Lottie gets really up close to her, until that moment where she's tearing up the flowers, that she sees her as like a full person. And I think that moving through this space and experiencing the works firsthand, recognizing kind of your own like bodily presence in front of these sculptures really does that to you. It really does change kind of like your understanding of death. And so much of that is indebted to this like intellectual knowledge of and background with animation, which I think is really interesting. And maybe we can touch a little bit on, you know, what, you know, if these sculptures are on the wall now and they're removed from the context, like what is the context? You know, what was happening in this kind of image before?
Yeah. I was thinking of, like, as you were talking, I was thinking about how when I studied animation, it was hand-drawn animation, and so without the proof of whatever film or videotape, I would photograph every single frame of animation, the stack of papers was not much of anything, and the stack of painted cells was not much of anything besides a bunch of pieces of plastic that should be recycled. And it is strange to think about the life of what is essentially the unseen labor that it takes to make something seem easy or seem presentable. How are we accountable for that part of a story? And so to mask out or to sort of white out these images as I've seen them or as I've discovered them on the covers of comics is to isolate not the stars, not to isolate Donald Duck or Betty Boop or Felix the Cat, but to consider the unseen parts of a picture and how they are powerful.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a little bit about Hannah Frank has this excellent book called Frame by Frame, where she basically takes kind of like a Frankfurt School approach to animation. And she argues that so much of what animation is, you know, products of single frames, and so much of that labor, so much of that prefigures a lot of really interesting formal techniques in film. So like flickers that Paul Sheritz and Tony Conrad were doing, that actually happened in like Mickey Mouse cartoons before they happened elsewhere. And I think that both acknowledging that sort of hidden aspect, but also thinking about each of these as an image that was part of, like, you know, a larger kind of trajectory, and thinking about maybe how that there are still like vestiges of that there. Like the idea of them, I think, feeling bigger or smaller as you move through the space is a kind of weird, it's a kind of kinetic thing onto itself, but they're resulting from that single image. And, you know, one of them is the Pied Piper, Bugs Bunny playing the Pied Piper. They're figures, but as you said, we're not highlighting kind of the central characters. We're thinking about that context. And I think doing that is also another way of like shifting our perspective, like really kind of changing how we view both our cultural icons and kind of the sort of vast amount of culture we have and images, and how do you sort of take that moment and like slow it down and like, you know, pause I think by kind of exploding these into huge scale, you make that pause like very immediate. And maybe, you know, thinking about slowing that time down is something that's interesting to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, if it's like making a quilt, I mean, to make a textile work or to make anything at such a scale, it affords you the certain kind of time or the nuance of these drawings that were probably made at rapid fire pace. And in the early 30s, when there was a kind of full animation technique where the studios had new access to big production and they could do all of these photographic tricks, make things misty or deep space or atmospheric, they flexed in a lot of ways, but it was a bit of a glut of stuff. It didn't always read well. And so to kind of wipe all that away and spend time with one singular image, it allows you to think about the power of the singular image, but also what happens before or after. I think for all of these particular objects in this space, they allude to someone or something that is not here. For instance, the broken pumpkin, which is something I think about a lot, because it's proof that time exists when you're sleeping and that things happen in the night that you cannot see.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting because when you look at these and their sort of scale and their color and the kind of graphic nature of their making, you might sort of associate them with, you know, feeling happy or something. You know, I think a lot of what is maybe like a sort of flat or a sort of surface level reading of work that pertains to cartoons or, you know, derives from what is children's entertainment is that it's very naive and simple, but I think both the image of your nephew and these works allude to the fact that actually, you know, there is this kind of macabre sensibility to it. There is this kind of ominous nature to it. And children aren't unaware of that, you know, or that perspective. I think, again, pertaining to like the way that Marigold unfolds, it's not as if the character is kind of doesn't recognize that the world is hard. But she has, you know, this moment or this space where she can kind of fantasize or think about, you know, what could be different, how things could be different. That sort of potential, I think, is something that perspective and your use of kind of decontextualizing these things from their sources allows us to do as viewers, maybe. I think if we can sit and contemplate or think about, okay, I don't know what the source image is for this, or I don't know exactly what the context is for this, but this is a way of for me to, I don't know, think the world a little bit more differently, think about the existing things differently. The husband pillow back there, so that the source for that is the Little Prince. And that story, the titular character of the Little Prince, or the narrator, sorry, of that story, talks about how when he was a kid, he used to draw a snake eating an elephant, and that sort of engorged bump. And when you show this drawing to adults, they would be like, oh, you know, nice hat. And he couldn't get them to see that engorged snake. I think trying to sort of reconcile the impossibility of someone seeing from your exact perspective is also like a big kind of undercurrent to what the exhibition is. You know, given that we can't do that, what are spaces where we can, maybe, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think to start the show again with the image of this child who's sleeping, it reminds me of something like Paranormal Activity, the beloved film series about a poltergeist living in a house, in a suburban house. And for me, one of the scariest parts about that film is the sense that when you sleep, someone might be watching you or hovering over you. For me, when looking at work at all, ever, there is this, we sort of dance for camera. There is this notion that when we look, we are also being looked at. The reference to The Little Prince, I'm not so interested in it for its twee kind of story. What I think I'm interested in relationship to that sculpture of a snake that ate a husband is more about absorption and how we absorb and how we mutate as we absorb, where there is the self that we perform and then there is the self that is inevitable.
Right. I mean, it's how do you even sort of negotiate that what you see, how you see the world and what you either consciously or unconsciously, subconsciously kind of take in, so much of that is so indeterminate. It happens from the people around you. It happens from, you know, whatever environment that you grow in. And what kinds of agency are we afforded in this sort of scenario? What are spaces where we can actually kind of break out of the idea that we have to accept what we have? I mean, I think that, like, what's so touching about the story about the Marigolds is that she doesn't, you know, there's no point at which in the story she just realized, you know, she's like, okay, you know, like, I get it, you know, like, everything's gonna be fine. She says sort of, you know, I remember this story, there's no reconciliation, it just happened to me, and, you know, what I have done in my life is plant more, I promised to plant more marigolds. She's not, you know, there is no kind of resolution, but there's this idea that I can still hope for something better. I can make, you know, spaces or make options, make kind of ways of lines of flight, ways of kind of dealing with, as you said, the kind of things that you absorb from the world around you. And I think that's also something that, as we move through this space and we see all these different works, both individually and together, we are kind of immersed in something that's detached from the world outside. But when we go back, you know, we still have to deal with that. So maybe, I don't know, maybe the way of thinking about your work broadly is, you know, affording people that option, affording people that at least within a certain amount of time, a way to think differently, a way to kind of not, you know, detach yourself, you know, in a dream, maybe that kind of platform from the violence, the, you know, the things that you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'd like to think it's necessary and also still possible to cut a hole in that wall and get the fuck out of here. You know, I want to think that's possible still. Even in relationship to our own tendencies as we live and breathe every day, right, that we can still turn another corner.
Right. I also want to, one of the things that's so kind of invigorating talking to you about the history of animation and sort of all the technological developments that allow for or enable our kind of understanding of movement and motion is that it all starts with a drawing. You know, it all starts, and that's largely Hannah Frank's argument that the hand-drawn frame before it was Xeroxed, you know, in 61, is the basis for understanding kind of our relationship to animation at large. And I want to think about that kind of the drawing in particular, because like if you look at so many early films, the way people, you know, characters, like Mickey will draw a hole on the floor, or and it becomes like a portal, you know, that it sets things in motion, right? So like starting from that sort of graphic linear activity opens up so much more. It opens up this whole new, can you imagine being like the first person to see like, you know, something like an animated cartoon? It's like it opens up this entire new way of looking too. And maybe I think thinking about the drawings as they've like kind of morphed here is a way of thinking about, you know, how to set things in motion generally.
I think when you just said that, I was thinking about my original title for the show, which was called Sticky Puffy. And I was thinking about this episode of Hoarders, where there's a woman who's walking through her house, and her house is full of stuff. She has so much stuff. And she's touching all of the things in her house and says something like, if it's not puffy, it's still good. And if I'm thinking about the world in the age of mechanical reproduction and this idea of glass and the screen and how we are constantly interfacing with each other through a pane of glass, constantly touching, touch, 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 touch. Ooh, it's Peter McGuff. I'm going to touch his face on my glass screen. I just love touching his face. But I'm not really touching his face. He's sitting right here. And how that's different than the puffy piece of bread that I'm touching. And for me, as a body that is lumpy in space, I'd like to think that the puff and the sticky still matter. And to favor those bits of emotion or those bits of physicality that we cannot see.
I mean, so much of, I think, your work and so much of the work in this show very obliquely, you know, touches on the idea of connection, right? So, like, so one way that the, you know, the character in The Little Prince, you know, tries to connect with the dolls is, like, showing them this drawing, this idea of the snake, like, you know, it doesn't work. There's so many moments, I think, in the, you know, that work in particular, like, let's say, you know, a key opening a door, like, leading to something else. There are all these moments of, like, intersection and possible connection that don't happen. They're kind of, like, short-circuited by looking at them from these detached, kind of decontextualized perspectives. And how does that maybe actually allow us to think with a little bit more clarity about connection, I think. How does that, if we're kind of constantly subjected to screens or all these sorts of barriers that prevent us from having empathy, from having forms of connection that aren't mediated, perhaps what it takes to shock us out of that kind of thing, to shock us out of that, like, kind of acceptance that we just have to accept that this is like how we have to relate to one another. You can't genuinely be empathetic anymore or whatever. In moments where you're sort of shocked out of that, you sort of, I think, recognize that connection is still possible. I do think that there is in your kind of warping of all these different cultural touchstones and different materials, it takes us out of that for a moment again, and then like when we go back in to the world, perhaps we recognize the value of connection a little bit. We recognize the sort of need for empathy.
I don't know if I want any clarity ever, maybe.
Yeah.
If this work or this particular square footage is, if anything, just a proposition to look and look again, and recognize that we gather moss, that we gather as we move through the world. The show begins with a kind of soup of letters in the front, which says, it's a short scramble of a poem that I wrote many years ago that says, in the night, I climbed through my window towards the ground, but never got there. And I imagine that that window is the same door that you came in. It is just one portal from one space to the next, but that you hopefully will never get there, whatever that is, that clarity.
I guess, I mean, I think that work in particular, the soup of letters, it points to, you know, why might it be important to give form to, or to write down, or to draw, or sort of shape all these fantastical propositions, you know, whether it's a snake or whether it's the, you know, a rabbit playing a carrot flute, or et cetera, et cetera. I think cartoons, a funny thing, quote I always remember about cartoons is that, like, Walter Benjamin thought that they exposed the barbarism of society, which is great. But I think, you know, because they exist in sort of a plane or a world that is so far removed and so many like things that maybe could not happen ever in life, like, happen. Like dreams, they by putting them down, you know, by giving them some sort of form or shape, by visualizing them, by realizing them, you're at least creating, even if you can't have, like, a rabbit playing a carrot flute or something like that, you're at least creating a blueprint for something, right? Like, maybe that can't happen, but something else might happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also, you know, what we talked about, this kind of moment, like, we're not sure. Maybe clarity isn't the right idea, but, like, there is a kind of recognition, like, of where we are, of our position. And I think that's very helpful. I think gaining that perspective, even if you can never sort of fully inhabit someone else's mind, if that kind of intersubjective connection is impossible, knowing where you stand is helpful in understanding, like, you know, maybe what could be out there. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if offering this kind of demented space as an outlet for anyone is productive, even if it's mania inducing, it's still a valid and important emotion, which is, if I can think back to Lisbeth ripping apart all these flowers, there was some kind of productivity in rage. There was some kind of productivity in action, and that's still important, to do things, to be in the world. And, you know, earlier today there was 50 fourth graders in here, and I was giving a tour to them, which is just me watching them all run around and touch everything. And and it was interesting because all of their questions were about cartoons and where did they come from and what was it made of and do cartoons really feel like this? Do cartoons really, is this really what they're like, to meet them in person? And that's a kind of interesting thing, to think about these common objects as your heroes, even, or something that could be a friend. I think that it's an interesting conceit when we are, in fact, in a world that's upside down.
Right.
So this presents a new kind of logic or a new kind of normalcy.
Yeah. I mean, so so little of, you know, I guess something that really kind of resonated with me and the idea that there is so much labor, there are so many unpaid love hours that go, that went into animation, that, you know, someone was sitting there drawing them, someone was creating this fantastical kind of world in, you know, very physically in the real world. I think it does kind of demonstrate to me, at least, the idea that it's not, you know, there is, not only is there validity, but there's also, like, an ethical reason for to kind of at least dream big, or, you know, think in very fantastical, idealistic terms, because it's, they set the stage for what is possible, even if, you know, these, if you can't realize them. I think knowing that someone spent all this time, you know, laboring over something that, you know, appears like magic, it is actually quite touching.
But also, I mean, the flip side of that is that, like, you enter the space thinking you're going to get your clothes cleaned at a cleaner's named after Bambi, and then you realize after watching Bambi that the dad gets shot. And so the Bambi is a horror film.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much, like, again, like, on, like, there's this tension of, like, impending violence in so many cartoons. Like, if you think about, like, Tom and Jerry, like, all the things that happen to, you know, Tom are actually, like, really gross and scary.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, this work is lifted from a Tom and Jerry comic, and what seems like a black line, an anonymous black line, is actually a hair on the face of Tom, and Jerry is holding the scissors. And so what seems banal is not. And the same could be said for all of the images here that are both sweet and happy. I mean, I heard someone come in earlier and say there's a bunch of happy stuff in here. And I thought, sure, yes, but also not. Yeah. And I mean, I think to do a to ever make anything is a proposition for, with many arguments or many endpoints.
Definitely. I mean, I like the idea of someone sort of walking through the show, not necessarily knowing what to expect, and maybe looking at that painting and hoping for, I don't think it's actually, like, immediately legible, like, what the phrase says, but kind of spending that time trying to figure it out is actually a kind of beautiful thing to think about. That someone is spending, you know, time they could be doing something else, thinking through what you might be, what you might have been trying to communicate. What, you know, what is it, like, trying in some sort of way, initiated by the kind of formal characteristics of that painting, to unscramble, to empathize, to really kind of put themselves in your mind. And I think not being able to do that is actually fine. You know, you're never, again, you're never going to get maybe that complete sense of clarity, but the time that you spent trying to figure that out, I think, is really, like, an ethical thing that that undergirds so much of why it's important to think about these things not as just happy objects, but, like, as things that maybe take us out of reality for a purpose, or make us do something. You know, they're not just kind of there to be, and there are beautiful aesthetic objects, but I think spending time with the exhibition and walking through it, and then walking through it and kind of thinking about, like, the journey you took from one end of it to another, like in a film, what that, how you might have changed in the process, and how you might have changed, how the works, you know, figure differently. I think that's a really nice thing that you do in your work generally, because it's not overly didactic. You know, you're not being forced into kind of an argument. You're allowed to explore that yourself.
Thank you. I think we're... I'd love to take some questions if that's possible, if anyone has any. But I think...
So you always make these interiors. Mm-hmm. You work with the world of the cast. Mm-hmm. I don't love that. What is all these polka dots in this yellow board? Is it just aesthetic, like the floor is fantastic, this is the, you know, I love this shot, it's really good. Why the environments, and are you trying to get the person out of their normal life, or?
That's a great question. So I guess 10 years ago, I had written a bunch of these quick statements. I was sort of under, I was like not well, and I was on like a bunch of drugs, and when I was in the hospital, and I was kind of just making these little poems that I thought would be funny sculptures, and one of them was this poem that is in the front, and one said, "In the night, I planted marigolds around my bed to ward off the weeds." And another said, "A Swiss cheese worm crawls through my cardigan." And I liked the idea of, like, when I revisited them in the past year, I liked the idea that to explain a whole was to make a character that would be this Swiss cheese worm. And that the sole purpose of a Swiss cheese worm is to carve out holes in spaces all of the time. And I'm interested in this idea of poking holes in what would be a fixed mountain. You know, to say this mountain isn't fixed, this pumpkin isn't as you know it, these scissors aren't as they always have seemed to be. And there's a comic from the 50s called Little Dot in Dotland. And one of the covers of those comics is this really beautiful moment where she's painting dots. So she paints dots all over the place. It's quite like a celebrated artist that we know. And Little Dot is painting dots, and a mouse mistakes one of the dots to be a hole and does not go into the hole. So for me, this proposition that these holes in this hallway are just a throughway to another space, another chapter, this is proposition one, and that is proposition two, that I'm activating or reminding you of the cinematic time that's embedded in all fixed things, that every painting is a time-based work, and that your experience of them in an image on your phone, in a space with this yellow light, in a space after you've seen this large snake in the back, how do these things unfold? How do they change? And trying to, for me, to make a space like this is to try to capture a very finite moment in which these works will ever be this way they are performing.
Yes.
This is a happening.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, I was interested when we talk about animation, and I was thinking about Disneyland, which everybody loves Disneyland in California. And I went there and I went on all the old rides. I went to go on all the old ones. And everyone loves it, loves it, loves it. And then they go back to this foreign suburban house. And I think, why not make your house like Disneyland? You know,
yeah.
You love it. It's $120 to get in. And just to walk in the gate. And I was thinking, well, why don't you make your house like Disneyland? My sister had a house built, and I was like, who's an architect? It was like Jay Mills or something like that, and it was just a boring house. So anyway, I won't go on, but that's why I love your work so much, because it brings in this imagination, but then it also has like the scissors cutting a whisker on the cat, and that's how cats get around with telling things from their whiskers, so it's actually the mouse destroying it. But I was thinking about the rage in cartoons. The audience loves that, because they're so rageful, the people are so full of rage that they can watch the mouse and cat hit each other over the head and laugh because they're getting their rage out by laughing.
Which was, you know, in Prohibition era, Betty Boop was boozing the most, you know, more than anyone, because she was sort of the mirror to the times. And it's, you know, funny to think about a show that looks like a circus in a time that,
yeah,
that is a circus. I guess it's sort of like how if you ever get a free newspaper where there's a crossword and then they have the answers in the back, like, and some people just go to, you know, some people just jump to the answers. You know, when I go to a movie, it was the last movie I saw. I didn't see The Lighthouse, but I like thinking about if I went to see The Lighthouse and then I really wanted to take Willem Dafoe home with me because I love him so much. And that's not possible. I can just, like, wait to get it on Netflix. And so, for me, to make one show that involves time-based media or work like this, my interest is in the division or sort of the inability to access. You know, everyone, including my mother, will say, can I touch these? And I'm like, no, Chris, you can't. Relax. But there's this, but that's an interesting, it brings out an interesting urge in people to want to touch something that's tactile. And I present it in that way. Like, I want there to be a kind of fantasy afforded and also a resistance to that fantasy. So you can, you know, look at this pumpkin, run down the street and see which one matches it, you know, and kind of keep it in your brain. But that's interesting. One of the earliest shows I did 10 years ago was a proposition of the same show working with 13 artists in two spaces about a mile apart from each other. And one was in black and white and one was in color. And my thought was that there was no label, so all of the work that I borrowed from these artists were sort of folded into my own work. And I made these weird stages, and it was called The Island Beautiful Immortal Mirror. And my hope was that if you went to the one show and saw the show full of color, say, or black and white, and then you cross town and you see it again, that in looking and seeing something shockingly familiar, it would allow you to be outside of your own head. And it was my first kind of attempt at being outside of my own body or outside of my own self, and that what I was looking at wasn't my real physical experience, but a picture that I had just created in my head. And so that sort of is a relationship to that now, I think. Are there any other questions? Concerns? Hi, Linda. Okay. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.